Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A science story, huh?
Is NYU a scientist?
I felt right. I figured it out.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Story Collider, where we bring you true personal stories about science. We are your hosts, Aaron Barker.
And Liz Neely. And this week, we are presenting stories that are all about our connections, both online and off. Welcome to our episode about love and technology.
Yes. So to prepare for this episode, we asked the Story Collider team what their experiences were with technology, either interfering with or facilitating their relationships.
And it was good.
Yeah. We certainly learned a lot.
We did. Which ones were your favorites?
I think my favorite is from Ray, one of our producers, who told us that she was proposed to over Skype.
Successfully.
She was in a long distance relationship between the States and Iran, and her husband proposed, and then Skype froze right at the critical moment when she had to give her answer.
As I understand it from the storytelling nerds I hang out with, that's called dramatic tension.
Yeah, definitely.
I think my favorites just kind of points out that no matter whether we're talking about like online relationships or real life ones, we kind of have the same reactions. Like one of our producers who shall remain unnamed was daydreaming while she was driving, not texting, but thinking about the chat she was going to have with a certain gentleman and managed to rear end the person in front of her.
Love is dangerous.
It is.
I think, yeah, my final favorite that I want to mention is Sam, our brand new St. Louis producer, told us that he matched with a woman on Bumble who assigned him homework pre-date. She told him to watch several episodes of the show Parenthood so they would have something to talk about, which I love. I love the idea of assigning homework and preparing discussion questions before a date.
I feel like it's a really effective filter. And just think about how many people on our team right away would be like, is there assigned reading? Oh, yes. I would like to date this person.
I mean, really, there should be a syllabus prepared. So I think we will continue to see how love and technology interact and play out together in our stories today. Do you want to go ahead and introduce our first one?
Oh, absolutely. Our first story is from Sammy Kamkar. It was recorded in August 2019 at the Lyric Hyperion in Los Angeles. The theme of that night was breaking the code.
It's 1995. I'm 9 years old. I'm sitting on the carpet floor of my mom's apartment, and this is the best day of my life. My mom just spent everything she had juggling multiple jobs to buy me a computer so I'd be less alone and have something to do during the summer. Immediately, I dial up and I find IRC, Internet Relay Chat. And I jump in a channel and I say, hey, who wants to chat about the X-Files? And immediately somebody responds, get out. I said, we can chat about something else. We could chat about, like, the Wonder Years or Sliders. And he says, you have 10 seconds to get out. I'm like, no. 10 seconds later, the brand new computer that my mom spent everything on crashed with a blue screen. And I freaked out. I pulled the power from behind the computer. And I waited for about 20 minutes for all the bad stuff to get out of the computer. I plugged it back in, and everything was fine. But as the adrenaline was pumping through my veins, I thought that was the coolest thing ever. How do I do that? I quickly found that the person on the other side was using a tool called WinNuke 95 and used that to crash my machine. And all of a sudden, I now had that superpower. Now, I'm not a malicious person, but I had no intention of using it, but there really is something super intoxicating about being able to use science and technology to reach out and manipulate a system in a way it was not intended. It really is. Pretty soon after, a couple weeks later, Microsoft released a patch that prevented WinNuke 95 from working, and all of a sudden my superpower was gone. I thought, okay, well, could I make the next version? Could I learn what that person did and then make WinNuke 96? So I then spent the next rest of my life learning how to reverse engineer, to design, to build, to fabricate exploitation tools. I continue this on to my teens. Now I'm about 15 and I'm writing open source cheat software for the video game Counter-Strike. And it's fun for a little bit, but once you pretty much have God mode, it's not fun anymore. Until they come out with a software called Punk Buster that stops software like mine, cheat software like mine, from working. And all of a sudden, the game is fun again, because now it's cat and mouse. They come out with a version that stops my software from working, and I now have to create a new version that evades their software. And I decide that this is a lot more interesting than high school, so I stop going. I continue building this cat and mouse until a few weeks later, my mom loses her primary job and says, "Sammy, you have to get a job. You have to pay rent." And I say, "Okay." So I start filling out applications and I get an email from a random company and they say, "Hey, we saw your open source software. Can we hire you to write some software for us?" They'll pay you to write code? Like, blew my mind. So I begin consulting for this company remotely, and after a few months, they're like, "Would you come down to San Diego and work for us full time? You'll make enough." I learned I'd make enough to pay for both support both my mom and myself. I jumped into my mom's car, no license, drove down to San Diego at 15. I showed up. They're like, "Wait, you're 15? I said, "Don't worry about it. Here's a work permit from my school, something I'd forged to a school I wasn't going to. I rented an apartment with an emancipation document showing I was an adult, something I had fabricated. No one's ever seen an emancipation document in their life. And started my new life. It's now 2005. I'm 19. And I'm now living in LA. I have a tech company, and I'm sitting in my apartment late at night. And a couple of my coworkers are on this website, myspace.com. And I check it out. I'm like, "This is kind of cool. You can have friends on here. You can share your interests." So I make a profile, and I wonder if I can make my profile cooler than other people's. So I look into it, and I find, yeah, I can actually add some code and modify some things and actually bypass some of their filters, and I can do some interesting things. I can actually make you add me as a friend just by visiting my profile. Like, that's kind of funny. What else can I do? Well, actually, because I kind of have full control of your browser at this point, I can make you modify your own profile without knowing it and add to the very end, but most of all, Sammy's my hero. It's kind of funny. So I launched this, and a few days later, I only have one new friend. I'm like, "Oh, that's lame. What would make this spread a little faster so I can just show off to my coworkers?" So I think about it. I'm like, "Well, if I can make you add me as a friend and add me as a hero, can I just copy the code to your profile? So if she visits your profile, she'll add me as a friend and add me as a hero and copy the code to her profile. And in a month, I should have dozens of friends. It'll be so cool. Show off to my friends." So I launch it late one night, and I go to sleep. I wake up in the morning. I'm hoping I have at least a few new friends. And I wake up to 10,000 new friends. and I freak out. This time I can't pull the power from the back of my computer. I don't know what to do. I email MySpace. You know, it's a virus, so even though I removed it from my profile, it's still spreading. And I say, I'm a random user on MySpace. I don't know what happened. There's this weird, like... just this weird obfuscated code on my profile. I'm not sure what it does, but I think it does detailed explanation of exactly what this code does. And if you were to stop this virus, whatever it is, detailed explanation of exactly how to stop this worm. Good luck. And I hit send, and there was nothing more to do. So I drove to work. It's now 50,000 new friends. It's lunchtime. I'm not hungry. I just try to work, even though I can't really do anything. And then I go home, and I come home. I have a million new friends on MySpace, and I can't do anything. Then I'm just purely curious, how fast is it actually increasing? Because these are all unique and individual users who are logged in. And I refresh, and I refresh. It's about 3,000 people per second that are getting added. And then I refresh, and finally, my profile has been taken down. I'm like, okay, that's great. I wonder if the code is still on other profiles. And I go to somebody else's profile, and this profile is taken down. And I go to MySpace.com, and it says, MySpace is down. Oh, the whole team here is here working on it. And I feel awful. I never meant to crash MySpace. I don't know what to do. I wait a couple hours, and finally it comes back. My profile's still gone. A million other profiles still say Sammy's my hero at the bottom. And I go to sleep. I wake up waiting for a knock at the door from the internet police. A week goes by, a month goes by, 3 months go by, and I'm like, I'm super fortunate that that didn't end any worse, and I'm never doing that again. So that chapter is done. 6 months later, I'm walking out of my car, and I see two guys standing next to it, and two more guys come up behind me, and I'm like, oh no, I'm getting carjacked. They say, Sammy? I'm like, oh no, carjackers don't know your name. Say, Sammy, we have a search warrant. And they all show me badges. Secret Service, Electronic Crimes Task Force, LADA. And I don't know a lot about search warrants, but on 24, there was like, show me the search warrant. I say, show me the search warrant, please. And they show me a search warrant. I was like, oh, okay. So we go up to my apartment, and there's another dozen agents with guns going through everything. And they're taking anything with data. They take my laptop. They take my phone. They take my 4 GB iPod mini. And then they leave. And they're taking, just walking away with my life. And I'm like, are you guys arresting me? And they're like, no, not yet. So I call an attorney, and he says, okay, like, yeah, the DA wants to put you behind bars and take away your computer use for the rest of your life. I'm like, I can't do that. I'm 19. I support my mom. I don't have a high school diploma. I don't have any other skills. They're like, okay, well, we'll see what happens. So we go to court, and they take away computers for the rest of my life, and they take away the ability to touch the internet for the rest of my life, and I'm not allowed to visit MySpace.com. Under one caveat, that if I'm on good behavior, after several years, if I did all my restitution and probation and community service and blah, 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 I can then go back to the court and hopefully request from the judge that I can get most of that removed. And then I leave the court, and I can no longer touch a computer. Now, as a lifelong introvert, I'm forced to do things I'm really uncomfortable with. I start to like read books. I go outside. I'm like, what's that bright light? And I'm forced to talk to people and socialize and actually, you know, start to bond with people out. And I continue this for the next few years, and 3 or 4 years later, I go back to court and I say, hey, judge, you know, my probation officer says I'm her favorite client. And I'd like to, you know, see what I can do. And judge says, okay, All restrictions are gone. You can touch computers again. And this feels like the best day of my life. I leave the courthouse. I drive to the computer store. I buy a 15-inch MacBook Pro with aluminum unibody. I go to the coffee shop. I open it up. I connect to Wi-Fi. And I realize at that moment, I don't need this at all. That time away from computers gave me the thing I was seeking most, which was connection with other people. After a few minutes on the internet, I shut the laptop and I went to visit my true friends. Thank you.
That was Sammy Kamkar. Sammy is an independent security researcher and self-described huge nerd. His open source...
Aren't we all?
Well, listen to this. His open source hardware and software highlight the insecurities in everyday technologies. And this is like a personal nightmare for me because he works on things like weaponizing children's toys to unlock cars, designing clandestine wireless keyboard sniffers hidden into mobile phone chargers, and best of all, building drones that wirelessly hijack and control swarms of other drones. Because what could possibly go wrong?
Okay. Yeah. Great.
Sammy is someone you want to keep on your good side, on his good side, because his work has been cited by the NSA, has triggered hearings on Capitol Hill, and has been the basis for security advancements across vehicles, smartphones, and other technologies.
Wow. Wow. I feel paranoid. But if you're into the stories from this episode and you want to listen to more stories about love and technology, I have some recommendations.
Ooh.
Aaron's Story Corner.
Gather around, folks.
I would recommend Sushma Subramanian's story from our Sense of Touch episode.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Sushma is a science journalist, and her story is about using haptic technology, or technology that creates the experience of touch, to stay connected with her long-distance fiancé, and it's one of the more romantic stories on our podcast, I would say.
I also like to say that I think I have Sushma's story to credit for a Christmas gift. My sister gave my husband and I haptic bracelets this year. They are designed, so that no matter how far away we are from each other, we can have the experience of... Well, I mean, right now we just basically use them to like annoy each other. Like, I'm poking you. I'm poking you.
I was gonna say, how do these work?
So there's a little light, and then it's also, it's kind of like that sense of touch, like you've just been poked. We might be using these wrong. Who knows?
Cool. Speaking of favorite stories, the Story Collider is celebrating its 10-year anniversary this year, as we've mentioned.
That's right.
Yay.
10 years.
To celebrate, we are asking for help from you, our listeners, the greatest science story fans in the world. Is there a story from these past 10 years of our podcast that really resonated with you, that stands out to you? If so, you can vote now on your favorite story if you go to our website or any of our social media accounts. We'll also include the link to the survey in the notes for this episode. And the storyteller that receives the most votes will be invited to reprise their story at our 10-year celebration here in New York.
Oh, we're excited. And if you perhaps only remember some of the details of the story, that's okay. You don't need to give us a specific name or hyperlink, because Aaron has the secret superpower.
Yes. Yes, just describe it as best you can. I happen to have in my brain an encyclopedic knowledge of pretty much every story ever on the podcast.
It's true. She does.
It's my one form of intelligence. Please let me use it. And I will figure out which story you mean based on your description. I promise.
Aaron, pop quiz. What is the story about brains in the trunk?
Why, Liz, I think you're referring to Bradford Jordan's story.
Dang.
About the time his dad left a brain in the trunk of his car.
She's so good, folks. Get your votes in.
And also, just one more quick thing. A reminder that you can subscribe to Story Collider at patreon.com for just $5 a month to receive bonus content. I just put up an extra story for our patrons today. And Liz and I also conduct behind-the-scenes discussions and interviews on storytelling, craft, and performance once a month, too, which are very cool.
If you are interested in questions like, how do I cope with stage fright? Or how do I come up with story ideas? Or what is the science behind that feeling of being sucked into a story? That's what the behind-the-scenes episodes are for. We interview experts who are scientists, performers, and we get to have a friendly chat with them to talk about all the craft and science behind what it is that we do.
Yes, perfect for story nerds like us. And I can only assume all of you.
Are you ready for another story, though, Erin?
Let's do it. Our next story today is from Jordan Bush. It was recorded in October 2019 at the Highland Inn and Ballroom in Atlanta. The theme that night was Deal With It.
On an unseasonably sunny day in March of 2016, in a garden that hadn't quite woken up yet, Alfredo proposed. I had two simultaneous reactions. The first was everything that you were supposed to think when the love of your life asks you to marry them. This is so great. I am so lucky. This is, you know, the beginning of the rest of our lives together, yada, yada, yada. My second thought was, it's go time. I have been reading, watching Say Yes to the Dress and reading wedding magazines for 10 years. I'm ready for this. Within, you know, an hour, I had a Pinterest board up that was filled with daydreams about how to make my rustic lakeside dream wedding a reality. So we got to wedding planning. You know, very quickly, reality started to impose some compromises, as with all things in life. It turns out it does not matter how cute she looks in a flower crown. The Catholic Church will not let your dog be in your bridal party. Yes. Similarly, serving dinner to your guests in artfully arranged picnic baskets is not a real thing, and it is not something that our venue was willing to accommodate. So these details aside, our wedding very quickly shaped itself into exactly what we wanted it to be. And one of our favorite parts of the whole endeavor was just seeing how excited our parents got about every single little detail and how much Alfredo's family's and mine really started to blend into one. So 6 months before the wedding, all the big stuff was done. The venue was chosen, the dinner menu was picked, the guest list was finalized. The hard part was over, we thought we were in for smooth sailing. And it turned out we were wrong, because then we got a call where we found out that my father-in-law, Jose, had cancer. A call that changed just about everything. So multiple myeloma is a nasty, unusual type of cancer. Unlike most cancers, where body cells reproduce uncontrollably to form tumors, in multiple myeloma, blood cells produce a bunch of unneeded proteins. These proteins clog up your system, just generally slowing down your body. And in the worst case scenario, they aggregate in your organs and cause your organs to fail. In Jose's case, his kidneys began to fail within weeks, followed by his liver, and eventually his heart. He began a series of increasingly serious hospital stays, ones in which his prognosis were pretty specifically not discussed. Jose had actually first been diagnosed with multiple myeloma almost 15 years before, when these certain type of proteins first started appearing in his blood. But the protein levels remained stable over time, and the doctors made a plan to monitor him closely over the years. Alfredo and I both knew this, so we assumed that the doctors were well prepared to handle his updated diagnosis. What we didn't know, and what the doctors didn't tell us at least, is that this was not the type of cancer that you recover from. The damage being done to his organs was irreversible. If the cancer didn't kill him, if the chemo didn't kill him, his failing organs eventually would. His expected life, even in the best case scenario, had gone from decades to months. So a month before the wedding, we flew across the country to visit Jose in the hospital. He was in his sixth week in the intensive care unit at the University of Washington Hospital in Seattle. His room was small and dim and loud, It was filled with, you know, beeping sensors and flickering monitors. There was this small window and a bouquet of balloons in the corner, but neither one of them did anything to brighten the room. Jose himself was on this giant transforming hospital bed that completely dwarfed him. His face had aged 30 years since Christmas, and he had lost nearly 100 pounds. Over the course of the weekend, we talked quietly about books and movies and current events. We prayed and ate ice cream and did slow laps around the hospital wing twice a day. We listened to doctors give those infuriating non-updates and watched as Jose painfully swallowed each of his 30 chemo pills. As we would talk, his hand would twitch toward the IV line that was always in his wrist that still hurt even weeks after they had put it in. His smile was there, but always guarded. His eyes were hollow. I think that he knew he was dying, but the rest of us, me and Alfredo in particular, just sank deeper and deeper into denial. When we went to leave that weekend trip, Jose sat us down for a reality check. "I'm not going to be able to make it to the wedding," he told us. His voice broke a little bit. We didn't have a good response to that, so we sat in a sad silence for a little while, and then we hugged him and kissed him goodbye, and then we left. And when we got home, we knew that a wedding is just a day and a party, and that clearly our family had much bigger things to worry about. But we were just devastated. You know, this was supposed to be the celebration of our families, and now one of the most important members of our family wasn't going to be there. Alfredo mourned the little moments that he had always looked forward to with his dad. You know, walking down the aisle at the end of the ceremony, checking each other's ties. We cried a lot in those weeks for Jose and for us and for this dream celebration that we thought we had lost. So 2 weeks before the wedding, while we were sitting watching TV after dinner one night, Alfredo casually mentioned that his parents were looking into buying a robot. A robot? What? I asked, and he was like, "Yeah, a robot for the wedding." Like, I knew what that was going on. Like, what? Like, what robot? I was completely confused. I was picturing Rosie the maid from the Jetsons serving appetizers to my grandparents. Like, what? And Alfredo explained that they have these little robots that you can remotely control and you can FaceTime from the head. And so with something like that, Jose could interact with our guests and our events in real time from his hospital bed, you know, with this little mechanical avatar. I was still a little skeptical because I did not have a good visual for what this was going to look like. But we were obviously willing to give anything a chance to include Jose in our day. So my in-laws bought a robot. And so on the day of our wedding, at exactly 10 o'clock in the morning, there was a knock at Alfredo's hotel room door. When he opened it, there was a family friend, and behind Daniel was this robot. It was about 3 feet tall, had a little low egg-shaped body with an arm sticking out of it and an iPad head on top. It, like, you know, motored into the room really clumsily and lifted up its head to reveal Jose's just beaming face. And he greeted Alfredo heartily and then kind of bumped into the room more awkwardly and, you know, greeted every groomsman by name. Jose controlled this robot from a private party that was put together by the ICU nursing staff in Seattle, where they decorated an empty room with streamers in our wedding colors, and they served appetizers and cake, and they helped him into tuxedos between tests. And throughout the day, it just really felt like Jose was there with us. You know, he chatted with my dad while the groom and the groomsmen got ready. He watched as Alfredo put on the special cufflinks that he bought them. Over the course of the day, the nurses would try and distract him with tests and whatever hospital stuff does. But he'd always wave them away and say, no, this is an important moment for me. At the ceremony, he sat in the front row with my mother-in-law. They watched us exchange vows. After the ceremony, he gave the two of us a private blessing about love and faith and family. when we went to the reception, he moved around the reception with his robot and greeted all of our guests. He laughed a lot when he invariably face planted on the rug, has happened several times. And our wedding just was this so much more beautiful than I could have possibly imagined. And it wasn't because of the dress or the flowers or anything on my Pinterest board, but it was because of the love that everybody showed to that little robot. We worried that people would think that that idea was kind of weird or entitled, but our guests really embraced the robot and Jose wholeheartedly. Our youngest guest, my little cousin, just delighted in the awkward little thing, and Jose had a great time showing off his movements for them. Our older guests vied for Jose's attention and always had just these wonderful, kind things to say to him. Jose passed away 3 months later, living just long enough to see the ultrasound of the grandchild that bears his name. In his eulogy, Alfredo wrote, "My father was a well-rounded man. Many of you will have known one or more of his many sides. Engineer, academic, athlete, artist, holy man. But to me, he was my father, and I loved him. And we loved him, and we miss him. But up until, you know, the last moments of his life, Jose loved to tell the story of our wedding and how, thanks to some clever technology, he was there. Thank you."
That was Jordan Bush. Jordan is finishing up her dissertation in ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Her research focuses on when and where lizards fight over territories. She asks that you not confuse her obsession with lizards as a general interest in all reptiles. She does not like snakes. Keep your snakes to yourself, she says, which
keep
I respect.
Keep those boundaries
yes.
strong. Exactly.
It's good to have boundaries, Jordan. After graduating, she has a real goal of becoming a professor at a liberal arts college and a secret goal of becoming a science journalist and children's book author. She currently...
Not so secret now.
Yeah, the secret's out, Jordan. She currently lives in Knoxville, Tennessee with her wonderful husband, two babies, and two dogs.
The Story Collider is grateful for Sammy and Jordan and promises not to talk about worms or snakes mm-hmm. with them. The Story Collider is also grateful for the support of Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science.
The Story Collider is led by me, Artistic Director Aaron Barker.
And me, Executive Director Liz Neely. We couldn't do it without the help of Deputy Director Nissa Greenberg, Operations Manager Lindsay Cooper, and the rest of our amazing team.
Stories featured in today's podcast were from shows produced by Audrey Kearns, Joseph Scrimshaw, Emma Yarborough, and Mesa Salida.
The podcast is edited by our podcast team, which includes Zoe Saunders, Jun Chen, and Gwen Hogan. The theme music is by Ghost.
Special thanks to the Lyric Hyperion and the Highland Inn and Ballroom for hosting these shows.
And to all the computer science nerds that I went to college with who hacked my systems for a few years. Thanks for not spilling all my secrets to the universe.
Wow. Well, that's a whole other story. And thanks for listening, everybody.